How do we help instill in them our mission, vision, values? How do we even communicate those things? What does that onboarding process look like? Because we had something in office, but that doesn't translate. And so how do we need to adjust that? What is the frequency in which we need to be meeting in person?
Run toward the unknown. When you're riding the big wheel, you're not alone.
Today, I'm talking with Christy Johnson, General Partner and Chief Performance Officer of BIP Ventures, the North American Venture Capital Division of BIP Capital, one of the Southeast's largest and most active venture capital firms focused on early stage growth companies. In this two-part series, we're going to be talking to Christy about what continues to be top of mind for company leaders, which is how companies can adapt and continue to grow in an uncertain and difficult economic environment. We then explore the future of work and what the workplace of tomorrow will look like, and how you can leverage AI in the workplace and in your personal life. Finally, we'll just talk about what it's like leading as a woman, things that she's learned, and things that are ahead for her on the horizon. It was a very fun, extremely informative, and very fast podcast for me, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. And as always, may this conversation inspire you in your own personal and professional journey of life. Christy, thank you so much for being here with me on our podcast. I know we've been planning this for a while, and I'm really glad we were able to get together.
Well, I very much appreciate you having me.
So the first thing I just wanted you to talk about is a little bit about your company and, you know, what you do, because I think that people listening would be really interested to hear about your line of work.
And maybe I should start maybe talking about a little bit about my background, because that's kind of what brought me to where I'm at right now. But I started out as I thought I was going to be an expat and that I was going to be working for a multinational company. And I went to graduate school at what was called an IMBA, so an international MBA. At the time, there was only two schools that did that. So there was Thunderbird and the University of Denver. So I was in Colorado, so I went there. And as soon as I graduated, my first job out of school was a joint venture with the IMF and the World Bank, and they were giving microloans to small businesses in Costa Rica. So I thought I was going to be going to a very large company, and ended up working with very small artisans. And it was very rewarding work, and it basically, I think, put me sort of on track to, I've always worked with either in or with small and scaling companies. And so that was a great experience. And it was probably the first time that I really recognized that small things that you do to get better actually have pretty profound, or can have pretty profound outcomes. And so, you know, you learn all this theory in school, but it was sort of a very hands-on practical application of things. So it took it from the classroom to, you know, immediate sort of gratification. So since that point in time, what I do now is somewhat similar. Just the gratification of seeing the impact is a little bit longer. But from there, I came back to the States and started working for, I was in industry. So I did construction. So I was in a steel manufacturing company. I also then went to plastic injection molding company. And so from some very weird twist of fate, I ended up in 2008 coming to Atlanta to work with what was at that time a startup, which was a registered investment advisory firm called BIP. And at that time, I had zero experience in any of that. I certainly had not grown up with investments or, you know, financial planning, any of those pieces, but I was very operationally minded. And that's what I was brought there for, is to put in sort of all the piping and to help build the firm. So I was definitely much more in an operational role. So we did that and built that. And then a few years later, then one of the offerings was venture capital. And so we were starting a small fund. So I came back to that side and started doing exactly the same thing. So putting in all the piping, building all the infrastructure, learning all the way through, because that was certainly things that I didn't have a lot of background in. But, you know, all things kind of look the same in terms of you have a process and you put things in place to make those things happen. And so those skills were pretty transferable. Then as we started making investments in companies, all the companies sort of needed help in some way, shape, and form. There was just a few of us there. And so I actually found great satisfaction in doing something different all the time. So I started leaning in and helping in all kinds of different ways, just kind of wherever they needed it. Through that process, we had one portfolio company where the founder got in some legal trouble. So I stepped in at that time as interim CEO. Then was at that time, like we thought that that would be like a couple years experience and that we would get the company stabilized and then bring in a different CEO. That 2 years ended up being seven. And it was a very humbling experience, and it was the most rewarding experience of my life. And I probably learned more in that 7 years than the cumulative of 27 before it. But it was, we got them to a really good place. And at the beginning of 23, so this year was a good time to sort of pass the baton, have a new CEO come in, and head back to BIP, where I was coming back to sort of put some formality around a process that's always been there, which is to lean in and help our portfolio companies, but put more structure around that and build a team that was very curated to the level of the companies and the like sort of earlier in their scaling than maybe what you see in a private equity firm, but actually put in some infrastructure that helps us do that in a repeatable and for me, was really important, a meaningful way. So that's what we're doing today.
That's pretty interesting. So that leads me to the first thing I wanted to ask you. And I thought it was really interesting that you just mentioned that small things and small changes can yield very big impact and big results. We've been facing, you know, globally economic headwinds and uncertainty, and so many things are going on. So, you know, when you think about growth, which I'm assuming that's what the objective is, yep, with these companies, helping them grow and scale, how do you think about that in really, you know, tumultuous times like now? Where do you start?
Yeah, well, I think that like when you're putting down fundamentals, I think that those sort of building blocks always look the same. I think what has been the big shift is that maybe even just up to 5 years ago, growth at any cost was sort of, that was the main theme. Mm-hmm. So it didn't matter if you were growing, you know, profitably, and it didn't matter if it was completely inefficient growth, you just had to show growth. Mm-hmm. So having that be the objective without any other constraints creates a lot of adverse behavior. And so a lot of companies were just hiring and, you know, just throwing tons of money at getting in customers without a lot of consideration to sort of the fundamentals of the business model. Mm. And so now, as two things have dried up, one is, you know, customers are getting much more conscious about sort of extra spend. And so there's a lot more scrutiny around, especially we're heavily in SaaS. So software purchases. And so if they can do without them and find ways to sort of cut corners, that's happening. And so you're having a constriction on, like, not only on the customers that you have, so churn potential, you know, churn headwinds, but you're also having to fight a lot harder for getting in new dollars and new customers. So that's happening. And then also sort of the safety net of, oh, I've raised this amount of money. And so I have a little bit of cushion so I can be sort of on a burn rate, and it's sustainable, because if I get too close to the sun, then I can just raise another round. That option is gone. And so efficient growth is the name of the game. So that is a lot different in terms of what has to be done and what we're looking at and what we're gauging and what success looks like. And so I think, as you know, as all of our companies are starting to think through, you know, they're just being super capital efficient and rational in ways that we didn't see before. And certainly the deal flow for us at this point is really good. We have never been in a situation where we're going to pay outsized valuations. It's, you know, our obligation to do the right thing for both the shareholders and the entrepreneurs. And like, paying up in a way that's absurd because the market is in some type of FOMO frenzy, we chose to sort of sit on the sidelines a little bit. And so now when the market is really good for investing in really good, strong, fundamentally sound businesses, you know, it's a really good time for us. But I would say that the biggest shift is just that we're focusing on growth for the right type of growth as opposed to growth for just any reason at all.
Now, when I think about companies getting efficient or operating efficiently, one of the first things that they look at, and we see this all the time, is they cut costs wherever and however they can. And there's a cycle. So as you know, we do consulting for sales organizations. The cycle is headcount reduction. Yep. Usually sales is touched last. You know, I can tell you that this happens time and time again, but it happens. And then as demand comes back, there's, you know, the push to hire and then the push to fire. And we, you know, I'd like to get your take on, we like to talk about this return on your sales investment. And we talk about how when you focus on efficiencies, there's really multiple ways that you can look at efficiency and multiple drivers to drive efficiency, not necessarily cost, because what we've seen is you can cut those costs and it looks like your EBITDA or your margin has gone up, but at some point, it's a short-term solve for a long-term problem.
Right. Well, I would say, let's be clear, when you're facing a RIF and you you know, have to get to sort of break even, which is sort of usually the impetus for what people are trying to do. They're burning. They know that their runway is about to come, you know, to an end. So they're facing, we're having to either downsize the organization or we're not going to have an organization. So it is very real. And so almost every department certainly gets touched. And as you said, sales gets touched the least or the last because of the fact that you have such a long-term commitment or investment in making sure these people are productive. And so if you think about what has to happen with a salesperson, you're usually three quarters out before you're actually going to see them contributing. And so they not only have to, you know, get onboarded and they have to get educated, then they have to build their own pipeline, take it through the entire sales process. So if you have a long sales process, say 6 months, it could be a full year before you start seeing any productivity out of a sales hire. You know, there's obviously onboarding and ramping for any type of position. But if you, and like you very astutely pointed out, if you go too deep in those positions, things will get better because they almost always do, especially if you're in a situation where you're becoming much more conscious about operating in a really efficient way. Then when the market does come back or the business is solid enough that you start to think about, okay, now we are in a position where we can put back our revenue generating positions, you're now a year away from when those people are, you know, going to be productive and start adding to the bottom line. There's also when you're starting to model out, like when you add salespeople on, you'll see the expense is immediate and the payback is lagging. And so just recognizing that those are those are key essential elements of what you're expecting and to see, and you know that those things take place, but there is definitely sort of delayed gratification on sales hires, no doubt about it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. One of the things that we like to think about are what are drivers where we could actually increase efficiency? And one of the things that we like to look at is sales capacity. So capacity, the revenue, right, that someone can bring in the course of a year, right, based on what they're doing. And we go through a process called, we call it job role decontamination. So we look at those value-added sales activities versus non-value-added sales activities versus non-sales activity, right? And on average, salespeople spend roughly 50, but we're finding it's actually a little lower of their time on sales-related activity. They'll call it 45%. If you can even drive that just 5%, the impact to revenue can be pretty significant. It's not a one-to-one ratio, but it can be pretty significant. So that's some of the things that, you know, like, Do you find that you're looking at things like that, like a sales capacity or other things outside of just...
Just headcount, yeah. Of course. Well, and the headcount's the natural place to go because it's the most immediate.
Yeah.
And oftentimes they're looking for, like, I have to have this done in the next 4 to 6 weeks. And so the headcount is a natural, like, first step. But yes, the efficiency question is not, like, what can we automate? Are they doing functions that can be moved to a different individuals? Like, are they doing, if we have them responsible for growth, should we move that to the CE team? There's also, like, how do we make them, like, more efficient in just overall revenue? So are we looking at margins? Are we looking at pricing? Are there things that we can bundle? Are we, you know, different ways that we can take it to market so that each person, if they can only have the capacity to close, you know, 20 deals a year, but those 20 deals lead are yielding a higher ASP, that in itself happens. So, you know, you're looking for all the ways across the organization. You're looking for tool cuts and other things that, you know, but again, those are so small in terms of, like, there's two things. One is that the immediate impact on some of the things that you're doing are longer term. And there's also, like, it's just so small, it doesn't move the needle. And so you're, like, cumulatively have to do it. So I think that you're sort of looking at it through two lenses. But to your point, if you only look at the short-term need of, you know, immediately cutting, and you're not cognizant of what this is, and looking at it as this is a continuum and this is a state in time, but we have to be sort of ready when whatever comes back.
Yeah.
And we don't look at it in a solely one-dimensional way, and we're much, you know, giving as much thought to what we have, where we have to be positioned 6 or 18 months from now, as opposed to where we have to be in 6 or 8 weeks from now. That's sort of the needle that you're trying to thread and the balance that you're trying to create. It's never an easy situation. The other thing that happens is a lot of these people have been with you from the beginning, and especially at the stage companies that we have, there's, like, really, really strong relationships, and many of them go beyond the four walls of the office. And so it's a very emotional time for many, many founders when many of them have faced it, but it is obviously not an easy time for anybody.
So let's talk about, thank you for your insight there. Let's talk about the future of work. You and I had an interesting pre-call about this, and we were talking about the future workplace in light of, you know, my gosh, we still have the, I'm so tired of talking about, are we working in the office or not?
Right.
I think, you know, my prediction is we're going to land at 3 days a week, just as a norm. And let's say that it's something like that. But, you know, just the future workplace, how people will engage with each other, how we look at development, you know, the pros and cons of hybrid versus in-office work. I mean, what do you think? I think 3 days, maybe you're thinking something else, and how, you know, just what we think that can look like.
Yeah, so I think, first off, I don't think the genie can go back in the bottle. So we've all experienced the sort of, what I'll call it, the upside of working remotely. And so I think a hybrid situation is sort of where we will end. And I think depending on the industry and depending on what you do. So there are things that are very easily done from home. I think that what you're also going to see, like, I think in many ways, like, creating opportunity for talent that otherwise had no way to sort of engage in ways that, like, traditionally, like, if you went and had a child and you had to be home for primary caregiving, your ability to sort of maintain, you know, a job at the office was not always easy because you had the, you know, the commute, and you had, like, hours that did not work for what you needed to do for your other job, which is taking care of your family. So, but there's so many talented women who are, you know, had to leave the workforce because they are, you know, starting their families. So it allows for both that population as well as, you know, using and utilizing talent from all over the world. So now you have, you know, it used to be that you were constrained with people who were in, you know, proximity to your office for your pool of talent. So now the world is your oyster and you can choose anybody that you want. So those are some very positive things. And in certain applications and in certain jobs, that works very well. Mm-hmm. I think what is yet to be seen is there's no doubt that mentorship is done very differently, if at all, remotely. And so if you're in a job where it is very important to be present, to understudy, to see how it's done by people who have gone before you. That I don't think gets solved with remote work. I think you have a version of it, but it's certainly not as comprehensive. I think what you're going to find is that the people who are in office are looked to for promotions and are, you know, given the opportunities because it just inherently makes sense. There are certainly companies that are 100% remote, so that probably levels the playing field. But I don't think in industries like our own and investing, there's no way you can pick up everything that there is to pick up or that you'll do it at the same pace if you're not around the office and you're not listening to conversations, you're not sort of absorbing things through just osmosis. And so I think that that is yet to be understood. But I do think that if I had to project and say, is there going to be more reward for being present and in the office? I think yes. And I think that that's the way it was before when, you know, going back to the female example, if we had to leave at 5 o'clock every day because our, you know, the daycare closed at 5:30, the person that could stay till 6:30 or 7 o'clock at night and was seen as putting in more hours then was rewarded in ways that the person who's not there and not present was not. I think that that's going to continue, no doubt about it. I think that it will definitely change or put more emphasis from a leadership perspective because, you know, just personally speaking, there was so much that was done from walking around in the office, seeing people. You can tell just from their body language if their day's off, and you can ask them. I'm listening to conversations that sales is having and that marketing is having. And so you can connect dots in a way that is not really available to you as a CEO when you're remote. And so I think that this issue of, like, it's always a core skill to be a really great communicator. I think it's even more important that you are in your, like, having to overtly make space for communicating in ways that is not, it may even feel unnatural at first because you're having to force conversations in ways that conversations just naturally and inherently took place when you're walking around. And so I think that designing ways, and there's all kinds of technology people are leveraging, and there's ways that teams are engaging, and then you're, you know, certainly going to understand people on a completely different level because we've sort of normalized having children come through and hop in your lap or animals or like walking across your keyboard. And we know people's families better than we ever did. And we certainly know, we have a much better appreciation for sort of who they are as individuals. I think that in itself with the newest, up and coming generation is important. And so I think that the skills that you need for communication and being in leadership, regardless of what role, will continue to change. And it's the person that really figures out how to, like, how do you stay in tune with your direct reports or the rest of your company in virtual ways that will be the most successful.
It's really interesting to see, like, I'll speak for myself as we've come back in the office. So we are at 3 days a week very recently. And now I've been 5 days because that's my choice. I'm leading the organization. But anyway, when we were asking people to come in 2 days and then, 3 days, it's kind of like, when is the company leaving, right? You kind of almost get used to having more days where you're focused, and getting your work done. But then I realize, well, when the company, which is really not the company, it's the team is here, they're booking so much face-to-face time with me and with each other. And I realize that, they need that time. So you're right. I think that as leaders, we've got to be really attuned to how we connect with people and
develop
out of the
them
office
because
and develop them.
The development is completely void in ways that I never really recognized would happen. When we were in the office, you talk about extremes. We went from completely in office to completely out. And we, of course, thought it was temporary. So, sort of like as you move through time, you're like, this is not temporary. So this is an ongoing situation. And then when you start hiring people, then you're like, And well, let me back up. When we moved, it was a cohesive team.
Okay.
So making that transition with a cohesive team that already has built trust and knows each other, like that did not feel that different because I already knew each of these people. I knew their idiosyncrasies. I'd worked with them for years. I knew them as people. I knew their families. And so it was basically like our little bubble went from the office to our homes and like we're here for each other. And so that was very, like that had its own set of challenges, but not really. It didn't feel like there was like this massive transition because it was the same team had moved remote. Then when we started hiring people, that's where it felt challenging. It's because you've now, how do we assimilate this new person who lives at their house into our culture? How do we create enough, like, you know, cross-functional exposure to everybody, not just the people that they're working with directly? How do we help instill in them our mission, vision, values? How do we even communicate those things? What does that onboarding process look like? Because we had something in office, but that doesn't translate. And so how do we need to adjust that? What is the frequency in which we need to be meeting in person? And then we started making decisions like, oh, this is great. We can hire people from all over the place. And, you know, we're not just restricted and look at this talent pool that we have access to. So almost just not by design, you start hiring people and then you wake up and you're like, okay, we are 30% of our entire team doesn't even live in Georgia. Mm. Okay, so now there is no option of going back to the office. We have, whether consciously or unconsciously, made a decision that we are a distributed company. That means that this is not something for the short term that we have to adjust to. This is how do we operate long term. And these are things that we better invest in, making sure that we, you know, not only can get people engaged in involved in the culture and the culture building, but also how do we mentor them and how do we get them good at their job and not just good at the things that they functionally do, but make sure that they are very much calibrated to the things that the other people in other departments are doing. And how do we create that cross-functionality and that cross-exchange in a way that doesn't dominate like work? And so that's the other struggle is, but then when I went back to BIP, it's 100% in office. Everyone, so there's certainly flexibility, but I found myself just jonesing for like a production day because so much of your day is absorbed with people needing FaceTime. So then you're just like, okay, I need to at least have one day a week where I am, and I call it my production day. But what ends up happening is that your calendar sort of still gets filled up, but you don't have the commute. I still probably need to work on figuring out sort of exactly how to manage that. But I will say it's very, very different. But I have this stark contradiction of like the company that had, you know, was in office and moved completely remote to a company that is primarily, I mean, they went through a period of time, but for the most part has remained in office, and just how much that helps with the culture building and helping people get skilled up.
Yeah.
And I do worry that it will, people who are young in their career, there is some limiting factor to not having, and it may be that it just takes longer because they're missing out on seeing people who do it really well up close and personal.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about young people. I have a nephew who he graduated, he was recruited early, like in January, and the pandemic broke out in February. He accepted a job. So he went out to Wisconsin. He's from upstate New York, working for a high-tech company. And he spent over a year working from his apartment. He hated it. He had no friends. Think about this, because he had relocated. He got a cat, who he loves now, but he never liked cats, right? They had boxers always. I like to tell this story. After a year and about 6 months, he called up his parents and he said, I can't
do this. Yeah.
I can't do it. He went to Colorado. My brother will tell you, he became a pothead, but he went to Colorado. He lived with friends there. He got a job outdoors that paid nothing because he's like, I got to be with people and outdoors, and, you know, just changed everything, and just said he was so burned out. So he came back to New York and he said, I will only look for a job
that's in
an office. And my daughter, who just graduated from college, she's like, Mom, you know all this stuff you talk about on your podcast about in and out of office, let me tell you about my roommate. So her roommate, who just got her master's, took a job. She was all excited. It was one day a week in the office, so she was excited because she could be one day in and work remotely. She quit the job. She said she wasn't getting any development, any exposure. She wasn't learning. So my question is, what about the, because here's what I see. Now, I work in an organization that's continuously learning. I don't care how old you are or how young, like there's a place for you here and you should be continuously learning because of the type of work that we do in consulting. So you've got the millennial or older, right? You got the Gen X, me and you, we got it. And maybe you're baby boomer. And they're like, you know what? I'm okay working from home though. I don't really need development. But I say, like, I want to know about the people around me and the younger people coming up, how they think, their ideas, how they can enhance and help me with mine. How do you even deal with that or work with that and make that a part of your culture? Because personally, I've seen it, and it's been very difficult to drive that change.
Yeah, and great question, and I'm not sure that I have the answer, right? So you're just constantly experimenting. I'd say the first thing is like being, you know, always have your finger on the pulse of like what's happening with the employee base. So constantly asking, what are you happy with? What are you not? What, you know, start, stop, continue. What are we doing that we need to do more of? What do we need to stop doing? And what are the things that we haven't even thought about that you think that we should? And so over and over and over again, employee development, their personal development was like at least in the top three. You know, so you're always going to have a comp benefits, but this issue of like, I want to feel like I am personally developing. I think that that's in like, that's inherently part of the you know, younger workforce is that they place an extreme amount of value on that. Even more so, I would say, than comp. I mean, it's like going to be a close second, but I think that if they had something that felt, and that's the other thing is that feeling like you're connected to a purpose. And so if you have employees, especially who are working remotely, who feel siloed, they are not connected to the overarching objectives and they don't see how their work is connected. So creating this connective tissue between everybody in the company and so everybody, so being extremely transparent, and you have to be much more structured in terms of This is our strategic objectives. This is how all these things roll up, and this is how why your work is so important. Being super communicative about like how the company is doing, and being transparent if it's not good. You know, so like we're all in this together, and we, you know, these are our KPIs, and this is how we're measuring against it, and making sure everybody understands how these things, like even financial objectives, how these things are calculated, how they're impacted, because that in and of itself is some professional growth. Like, oh, I didn't recognize how budgets are put together, how strategy is formed, making sure that every single person, and you know, when you have a super large company, it becomes much more complex. But if you have a company that's like 40 people or less, there is no reason why each one of those, you know, here the leadership team sets the main objectives and then that cascades down and everybody, you know, sees that they set objectives as a team and then they see how those things are connected. So making sure that they understand, so they get exposure beyond just their functional job, that they have exposure to things that because they're in a small company and because they're remote, we're doing an overt amount of effort to make sure that they stay connected. Even if that is, you know, once a month as a team going through like, hey, these are the things that we said that we're measuring and these are the things that are important. Here's how we're tracking against it. I think using technology to let them cross-pollinate because they, and it's like they're always constantly finding resources and saying, hey, if you have interest in this, and not making that just be about the company. Mm-hmm. Like there's all kinds of, we have a random Slack channel and all kinds of things are always, you know, put on there like, oh, if you have interest in space, like there's this great program. And so it's just become this place of collection of like random things, you know, aptly named Slack channel. I think, constantly recognizing work in a way that, and contribution in ways that probably in the past we would say like, oh, so-and-so's done a great job and here's a gift certificate or whatever. And I used to have a practice where I would just like, because if there's the formalized things, I think that's nice if someone gets it. Mm-hmm. But I also think random is way better. And just like, hey, you know, and it doesn't have to be much, but I used to like, hey, here's a, you know, $10 gift card from Starbucks. You did an amazing job on that call I just listened to. So it's not like they're just small things. And so that was a way to acknowledge that, you know, you recognized what they did. When you're remote, you're still doing the same activities, but you don't have that same thing, but just trying to put those into place. And so sending people digital thank yous. And but we have a also Slack channel where people reach out and then tie it to a core value. So just want to, it's a shout out channel. I want to shout out so-and-so and just making that inherently part of the culture, because I think part of professional development is also acknowledging when people do a good job.
Yeah.
And people recognize that if I go the extra mile, I get acknowledged by my peers. And so creating a culture that does that. And I just think figuring out ways, we have a portfolio company called Skill Cycle. They have, it's employee-led development. And so they had coaches. And so the company sponsors it. They do a 360. And that's also, like, I think companies large, small, and medium, like, they struggle with, we do a 360 and we have a, you know, our one-on-one annually, and we tell you that these are the areas that you need to develop, and then what? And how is that connected to a plan? Well, when you're a small company, you don't have a lot of resources. And so they have, like they'll do the 360 and then they identify areas that need development. And then they have coaches that are virtual that, you know, kind of pair them up with somebody that's their area of expertise, and they can help them. And it could be like anything, having difficult conversations, could be leadership skills, could be time management, could be anything that kind of they've recognized in their self-assessment and that, you know, the people that they work with most closely recognize as well. And then they, you know, they make sure that there's efficacy in what's happening, because they'll do it again mid session. So like if they have a 12-month timing, then 6 months through, then you'll make sure that you'll do that whole process again, make sure that they're improving. And so investing in things that like help you, like if you are a small company, people think that professional development is somewhat related to promotion, right? Like title change or change of responsibility. Well, when you're fairly flat, you don't have a lot of those options. So you have to figure out ways. You also don't have people who are exceptionally skilled or developed in developing other people. And so, you know, a lot of times you were the one that was the best at something, and then all of a sudden you're a director, and assuming that you have enough fundamental skills towards leadership, that typically lends itself to moving up the ladder. No one along that journey has trained you to develop other people. So people who are good at it, most times it's just inherently a skill that they have. And oftentimes that's coupled with being, you know, having exceptionally high EQ and understanding that people need that to feel fulfilled at work. But when you have the outliers who aren't good at that, they're not exceptionally thoughtful about how I would help develop another person's career. If you can put the hands in the development somewhat in the hands of the employee, if they want to self-actualize, and you spend the money in that way, because the other thing is that the managers don't necessarily have the bandwidth, then I think that just trying to think outside the box and ways that you can help develop people, not in like, oh, we gave you an LMS system and, you know, you can go take some like things online. That feels somewhat shallow. And so I think if whatever you do is leader or leaders in a company to try to make sure that that is happening, it needs to be meaningful and it needs to be real. And so there are all kinds of ways, I'm sure, like thousands of ideas out there that are great, but you have to get conscious that it is a massive responsibility that is made more difficult by the fact that you're remote, but it doesn't take away from the fact that it's essential to keeping happy, productive, and long-term employees.
Yep. I would agree with you. I think I always say that there is a value in long-term, healthy, and productive people, because if you have the first two, you'll always get the third.
No doubt.
Anyway, and it's interesting. So there were a few things. There were a lot of things that you said that were really interesting. One was around the learning. I know a lot of companies that implement the LMS. However, there are a lot of other, I think, and they're very expensive systems to put in, and not saying there's no value to that. There absolutely is. But if you can understand at the individual level, development based on where they want to go, you know, and how they want to achieve success in their own career and their life, and tailor it to that. There's so many resources out there. It doesn't mean you have to send them to school for their
right, or spend
MBA
a ton of money.
Or spend a lot of money. It doesn't mean that at all. I found, because we did this during the pandemic, when there were a lot of people that were just at home and we didn't have as much work, we offered that. And we're like, okay, oh my God, there's all these great classes. You can learn, become an expert in Power BI. You can learn about other technologies, different things that their clients were doing. You want to know more about Salesforce, HubSpot, whatever. And it was, it's just a little bit, you know, it benefits you as an individual, benefits you working with your clients or, yep. you know, in your job, but really paying attention. And then also the communication aspect you touched on, so much more important for leaders to connect and to understand why they're connecting, what the message needs to be. It's frustrating for leaders of leaders, so leaders of the C-level, to hear something like, well, the mandate is if they're not here, they're fired. When, you know, because here's just a message. Right now, I happen to like the in-office thing. But one of the common things to talking about messaging being different, we've asked them nicely to be in, and people are still just not coming in because it's an easy topic to talk yeah. about. They're out. Frustrating for the CHRO who said, yeah, but that was the thing. We gave people a choice. We were really soft on policy. We're like, we would like for you to come in. And then all of a sudden it's, if you're not in three times in a row, you're out.
Right.
Right. So we haven't, you know, the messaging all the way through wasn't really clear around the beginning. So I say that because clarity of messaging and expectations of your culture, of your vision, your mission, what you expect, leaders are going to have to really focus on that more yep. than I
they
think.
They have to make it a priority.
Yeah.
And it's always a struggle, even when you're in office. But,
yeah.
you know, I always say, like, culture happens whether you plan it or not. So why not plan it? And it's also the only time that you ever get to have control over and a say in, like, the types of people that you work with. And
yep.
so why not make sure that they're of like mind and, like, they embody the values that you've already set out that you think are important for your culture and for growing the company. So there's all kinds of reasons to do it. But I would say that not only do people have to stay more conscious, but also sort of think outside the box because and meet them where they're at. Because, like, a lot of our employees, this is the first job that they've ever had, maybe the second. And so professional development in our mind is classes or training. And so sometimes it's just exposure. So things that only cost you time, which is not free, but, you know, you can pair somebody, like, if they say, hey, let's, like, I want to be paired. I'm in sales, and I'd love to know what happens in, like, engineering. So, okay, well, there's an engineering stand-up. Why don't you join it, you know, and feel like there's some cross-functional exposure, just
yeah.
that. If employees feel that you're making an investment in them, albeit small, but that they're doing things to help you, then that creates a lot of goodwill. And so if it takes you a while before you can sort of afford to do something where we can give them a training stipend or, you know, that's self-directed or that we do things that feel like material training, I think that there's a lot of things that we can do just sort of like under the guise of just exposure and, you know, trying to make sure that they understand their option set as they yeah. start to go through their career, I think is highly valuable and really inexpensive. But because there's also advantages to the business to have cross-functional understanding, especially in a remote situation. So there's advantages on both sides. So looking for those opportunities, but we have to be much more conscious mm-hmm. of why that, again, I'll use the word connective tissue is so important because I think as we move through times, what happened to your nephew, and also so much is just introverted, extroverted. You know, we had engineers who were working remotely way before anybody else was
yeah.
because that was their preference.
Yeah.
And they were
yeah.
much more efficient that way and they felt uncomfortable and it's, you know, they're not to stereotype everybody, but that does seem to be the predominant choice if given an option there. And sales teams were like pulling their hair out and saying, I hate this, because yeah. they're typically more extroverted in nature and gain energy from other people. If you have your energy drained by being around others, remote work works great. And so, you know, also being calibrating as the leadership to the groups that probably need it, and even to the individuals who need it more. I definitely reached out to people who I knew were extroverted more so than, because it also feels highly uncomfortable to an introvert. You know, if I reach out to engineers, say, hey, you want to just jump on for a virtual coffee? you have something to tell me, where the you know, the salesperson says, I would love to, oh my goodness, I have so many things to tell you. And so, in, you know, I also would do like a lunch and learn, which with every department, where you just basically, it doesn't include their level of leadership, but you're just kind of going direct, and kind of the same thing, start, stop, continue. I cannot tell you the difference between the amount of conversation that takes place with the sales and marketing team and the CS team and takes place with the engineering team. Would you guys like me to tell you about this? Would you like to know about that? Because they're not going to be asking a lot of proactive questions. But so just meeting the organization and the employees where they're at. But as you said, in a much more focused and intentional way, because otherwise I think that it might not hit you immediately, but it is definitely, you're going to feel it in, you know, turnover and other ways, and also just culture building, because it's not gonna be what you want it to be if you don't invest, like anything else.
Hey, it's Michelle. Thank you so much for listening today. If you enjoy our podcast and know someone who you believe would make a great guest, I would love to hear from you. Feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn and let's talk. I'd love to hear your feedback. And as always, may it inspire you in your own personal and professional journey of life.